Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. Thank you for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. My number is 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Downers Grove, Illinois, and talk to Carol. Good morning, Carol.
Good morning, Patrick. I have a 23-year-old son living with his girlfriend as of August. He just finished serving 5 years as a submarine navigation specialist. Mm. He dated her the last 2 years of high school, and the relationship kept up. The additional 5 years, I began to realize she was visiting, you know, by plane, going to see him. Mm-hmm. So it's been hard knowing that. But then, of course, the hardest came when he moved in together in August. His father had a very serious conversation with him, and he went ahead anyway. Tomorrow I have the opportunity that I'm going to talk to him, and I know you've, you know, talked on the topic, but I'm always driving when I'm listening to you. And anyway, I need the guidance. I need, you know, to be as loving and truthful to reach him.
Yeah, you love your son, you want him to be happy, and you recognize that he's making some decisions that are taking him in the wrong direction. Maybe you can start with that. You know, maybe you can just start with that. Son, I love you. I carried you in my body for 9 months. I nursed you at my breast for however many months after that. I raised you. I taught you how to walk. I taught you how to talk. I taught you how to count. I've been with you every step of the way. I love you with all my heart. There's nothing I wouldn't do for you. So the reason that I'm talking with you about this is because your happiness is my happiness. And your eternal happiness is my happiness. And I raised you to know, love, and serve God. And you're doing something right now that is completely contrary to that. Not because it's not that it's contrary to what I want. It's contrary to what God wants. And so I'm just telling you because I love you that you're doing something that's seriously sinful. I'm sure it feels great, but it's still seriously sinful. And it would be wrong of me, and I would have to give an account to God in any case, if I didn't talk with you clearly out of love and compassion and tell you that what you're doing is wrong. I don't want to have that on my conscience for God to ask me, well, how come you never said anything? So that's why I'm saying this to you, son, because I love you. Now, if you are serious about this girl, I think she's lovely. I think she would make a wonderful wife. And I'm guessing at these things. But if you were to say that, you know, I think she's lovely and she'd make a good wife and you would make a good husband. So why don't the two of you, instead of living as if you were husband and wife and enjoying all the benefits of marriage without any of the responsibility, why don't you do it the right way? And why don't you prepare for marriage the right way so that when you two get married, if that's what happens, you've got a firm foundation to build on. You could point out to him, and I'll leave it at this, that any number of statistics, and all you need to do is Google this and you will find these statistics posted publicly, that demonstrate invariably that couples who live together before marriage have a far higher rate of divorce once they do get married. It's just a correlation between living together and divorce. And, you know, if he's serious about her and if they're contemplating marriage, then you could say, why on earth would you want to set yourself up for eventually having to part from this lovely girl if, as the statistics seem to demonstrate, there is such a high correlation between cohabiting and divorce later on? So these are some of the things that if I were in your situation, I would say, Carol. What are your thoughts?
Okay, yeah. I love that. I love that. Now, I, you know, sadly, I'm one of those people that, you know, I get a little emotional and a little strong when, you know, having a conversation like this. I was going to say, I was going to mention the fact, and tell me if you think that I'm incorrect, but also this is too much on the attack, okay?
Okay.
Because what I see is obviously they're using contraception, and almost every form of contraception, as I understand it, causes really an abortion. I mean, it kills the baby.
Well, if you're talking about the pill, for example, or the IUD as another common example, you're right. They do have an abortifacient component to them, and certainly the IUD does, no question about it, and the pill very often does. But that would be distinct from, say, a condom or some other barrier form
of
contraception.
True.
Yeah.
True. And I do know that for whatever her, you know, supposed health reasons, I know she's been on the pill. I know that, you know, in high school and everything.
Okay. So these two are in their mid-20s, I take it, right? Probably 24,
23.
25?
23. I don't believe any, well, of course, I'm just an ignorant parent, but I don't really think they had the, you know, serious sex life until he was in the Navy. But, you know, whatever. Water under the bridge now. But, you know, in my mind, that is so serious, you know, that they've conceived life and, you know, where
is that
life
now? Yeah, and those are your grandchildren. To the extent that there have been any conceptions that ended in an abortion because of an IUD or because of the pill, those are your grandchildren. Those are their children. Those are your grandchildren. And
right. And it's a compounding of the sin. I mean, it's not.
It is.
It's more than lust because it becomes murder in a, you know.
I understand. Have you, now, I know you're going to be speaking to him. Have any of these issues come up before, or is this anything that your husband dealt with when he spoke to your son?
I wasn't there when my husband spoke with him, and my husband is great. I mean, he's calm. He's just, you know, he's better than me at all of that. My kids totally respond to him. I mean, they love me. You know, we have 9 children. Unfortunately, or, you know, as society has this, we have had 3 become pregnant before being married. They are married with additional 4 kids or whatever. So, you know, one time I posed the question to Jimmy on the phone when I realized his girlfriend was making plane, you know, flights to spend weekends with him. And he said, how come it was okay for everybody else but not for me? And I said, it never was okay for anybody else, you know.
Right.
But, you know, his observation, I mean, and I understand it. As a younger sibling, you know, you watch an older sibling get married because they're having a baby. That's tough. You know, it blurs the line.
But you can always tell him, it sounds like you did allude to that, just say, you're right, and it was wrong then, and it's wrong now, and I want their happiness just as much as I want yours, and I told them the same thing I'm telling you. So why would you want to go down the same road and make the same mistakes when you can see how difficult it was for your siblings? Now, thankfully, they're married now, so that's good.
Right, and I don't think, well, I mean, I don't think he saw things as difficult for them.
Okay.
But, you know, the other thing that always came to my mind is, you know, what if you chose not to marry that person? You know, you have no choice now, basically. I mean, of course you have the choice, but it does eliminate the wonderful opportunity to choose a spouse when you're pregnant.
Right. That's true. Yeah. There are so many important levels of this discussion, Carol. It sounds to me like you're already on board with all of it. I'm just offering maybe a suggestion on how you could couch the message in a way that he might be more receptive to. But I think one thing that my sense is that many parents today fear is to be firm and forthright because they fear getting shut off by their children, their adult children. They fear that, you know, well, maybe I won't be allowed to see my grandchildren. Now, that can be a genuine, well-grounded fear in some cases, because sometimes kids do that. They shouldn't, but they do at times, you know, use the children as emotional pawns and blackmail. Mom, I'm not going to come over for Thanksgiving if you talk about this again. So you have to be prepared that that could be part of the picture. Hopefully it won't be. But it doesn't alleviate the need to still speak the truth in love, to tell them the truth, even if there's some blow up that you don't want, or they, you know, they get angry or defensive. I mean, people are people, but you're in that position as mom because from all eternity, God chose you to be the mother of this boy. And therefore, you have special standing before God. You have special graces available to you before God. And you may already know all this, so forgive me if I'm telling you things you already know.
No, but you have
special status before God when it comes to this child and your claim on this child's happiness. So I would exert that to the hilt. And you and your husband both exert it to the hilt. Lord, you know, we know that you will bless us in a particular way if we intercede for our son who is in need, just like St. Monica did for so many years with St. Augustine, who was living an even more decadent life than your son is. Because although he did father a child with his longtime concubine, he was also playing the field. And he was doing all kinds of related things, sexually speaking. And his mother and her prayers eventually were, as he himself says in the Confessions, he attributes it to his mother's persistence in prayer that he eventually got out of that. So you're in good company, Carol. And it may not happen overnight, may not happen, you know, for some time, but your steadfastness will go a long way toward helping him come around.
Okay. Well, I think, you know, that's what I was looking for. You know, like you say, couching the way to get his attention and make him realize that, you know, I too, like his father, spoke with him. I have that responsibility and have only his best interest at heart.
Yeah. You know, that's one of the most important things right there, Carol. I've told this to all my kids at one point or another. There is nothing in this world I need from you. I don't need anything from you. I'm not trying to get anything from you. All I want is your happiness. So I and your mother are the two people on the face of this earth who will never try to get anything from you, because we don't need anything from you other than your love, of course. So there's no angle to be played here. There's no benefit to us. Our sole purpose is to see you happy. And there's really no one else in the world who can say that, other than mom and dad, in quite the same way. And I think kids need to hear that.
Right.
You could ask him, how would you feel, how would it make you feel if your dad and I had never gotten married and we were just living together? And we were just having sex and popping out babies, and but there was no commitment. There was no, you know, I mean, how would that make you feel? I'm guessing if he was really honest, he'd stop and say, that'd be weird. I don't think I would like that. So maybe you can leverage that to say, well, there's really no difference from what you're doing than if dad and I had never gotten married and we just had a really neat arrangement with lots of fun but no responsibility. Don't do that. Do it the right way. This is why God arranged things such that marriage is that institution that predates all religion. It's designed by God for the protection of the wife and the children. It's designed to require responsibility and commitment, a stable, safe environment within which children can be born, in which the wife is protected and nurtured, all of the things that go into it. And when you have two people just living together, enjoying the benefit of marriage, physically speaking, with no commitment and no responsibility, it just leaves the door open to chaos and heartbreak. In the long run, it just doesn't work. Even from a non-religious standpoint, eventually these things tend to break down.
Okay. Well, that sounds like some good ideas, and I appreciate it very much, Patrick.
You're welcome. You can do it, Carol. You can do it, and I'm sure you'll do it with grace and love. And it may take several times, but you can do it.
Right. Okay. Well, that you've been a big help. Thank you so much.
All right, Carol. God bless you. Thank you. And let's pray that Carol's son listens to his mother and his father. They're telling him the truth. And sometimes young people, they just don't want to hear it. So let's pray for Carol and her husband and their son. How about Mary now in Union, New Jersey? Good morning, Mary.
Hi, Patrick. I am calling because I have a grandson, 22 years old, who is autistic, but very capable of reading and understanding, okay. And he's really a great kid, who pulled up online two books of Mormon, and that he thought, he sent me the pictures of them and said, okay. This is what he would like for his birthday. And because it tells him how to be a disciple of Christ. Mm-hmm. Of course, that is not going to happen, and that is why I'm calling you, because I need some books that I could, in fact, give him that will, yes, bring him, you know, help him to be a disciple of Christ within our Catholic Church, within the Mother Church.
Right.
And I don't have the ability to be able to go out and, you know, span every single book out there to mm-hmm. find out what would be good for him to read. And
I have
that
some
he
suggestions.
Would like. Okay, yeah. Good.
I can help you. You came to the right place. So the first thing I would recommend, if you want something quick that you can get for free right away, is go to relevantradio.com/Patrick. That's the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. Just below where it says The Patrick Madrid Show in big letters, you'll see About, Links, and Contact. Click on Links, and then three or four links down, you'll see Articles. Click on that link. Now, this will take you to the page where I've got maybe, I don't know, 2-3 dozen articles that I've written over the years that are available as PDF documents. So they're yours for the taking. So each one that deals with Mormonism will have Mormonism kind of in parentheses. Maybe not each one, but several do. So the second one from the top does. Let's see. You want to get the one on In Search of the Great Apostasy. You want Mormonism's Gods. There's a second one, Mormonism and the Great Apostasy Theory. And there may be even another one beyond that. So 4 or 5 of these articles that are ready to go that speak to some of the key issues that he should know about when he's looking at the Mormon Church. Their official name is The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but virtually nobody says that because it's too cumbersome. But you get the idea. So that you can get right away. When you hang up, those are yours for the taking. Then I would recommend that you get him a copy of a book called Inside Mormonism. Now, this was written by a man named Isaiah Bennett. And I can see that I have, well, I think I can briefly explain this to you. You can get that book used or new online. It's fairly pricey new, but you can get a used copy pretty inexpensively. I strongly recommend it for this reason. Isaiah Bennett was a Catholic priest whom I knew. He was a pastor of a parish in Brooklyn. It was in Brooklyn. And I went out in around 1990 to his parish by his invitation to speak at his church to help his people understand the differences between Mormonism and the Catholic Church, also Jehovah's Witnesses, because he was losing a lot of people. And it turns out, there's a long story here, I don't have time to tell it to you, but it turns out that a few years later, I discovered when a Mormon fellow that I knew in Los Angeles called me up, that Isaiah Bennett had become so fascinated with Mormonism that he left the priesthood, he left the Catholic Church, and he became Mormon. And for a few years, he was like their Scott Hahn. And he would go to different Mormon churches and tell his testimony. And he, you know, was very well received, as you might imagine. In fact, I remember going into Deseret bookstores in Southern California and seeing in the Deseret bookstore, which is the Mormon bookstore chain, they had a dual cassette tape of him telling his story. Why did he become Mormon? Why did he leave the Catholic Church? So he was like a celebrity for them, and they were promoting his materials. Well, eventually, and this is where the long story comes in, but eventually he wound up going back to the Catholic Church, thanks be to God. He did not resume his priesthood because of the public nature of his apostasy, but he came back. Now, he wrote this book, Inside Mormonism, because he was inside Mormonism. He had a temple recommend. He went to the temple. He performed the ordinances for himself and by proxy for those who had died. He had received the Aaronic and the Melchizedek priesthood. He knows from the inside what it means to be a Mormon, and that's what this book is all about, written by a Catholic who was Mormon for some years, knows from the inside, and it's not just having read a book by somebody else and then regurgitating that information. This is his own explanation for it. And it's non-confrontational. It's not polemical. And I urge you, get that book for your son, because it's going to really help him understand many of the things that would be hidden from view if he were merely to be looking at the books that you just mentioned. Now, I'm overdue for a break, Mary, but I hope that's helpful to you. And we'll get a link posted to the book Inside Mormonism by Isaiah Bennett so that you can at least see it. Try to get it at your local Catholic bookstore if you possibly can. I'll be right back with more right after this. Today's programming sponsored in part by St. Gregory Recovery Center. More information about their Catholic-centered recovery from substance abuse is available at relevantradio.com/stgregory.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. At the intersection of faith and culture, the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
I love the Duran Duran vibe. Good pick, Cyrus.
Thank you.
Good energy goes with the program, doesn't it?
I love it.
Would that make you the Simon Le Bon of the Patrick Madrid Show?
Whatever you say, boss.
I could be the John Taylor, bass player. Yeah, you could be the Simon Le Bon.
I cannot keep up with you with the Duran Duran info.
Have you seen that interview that I sent you?
Nope, I have not watched it.
Oh, my God.
You keep telling me to watch it.
Your ignorance is your own fault. I can't be blamed for it.
All right. Facts.
All right, Simon. Now, this is serious, and my reaction when I first saw this was surprise, surprise, surprise. It's from the Washington Examiner. No one appears to have been in charge at Black Lives Matter for months. Headline is, Black Lives Matter's millions unaccounted for after leaders quietly jump ship. The address it lists on tax forms is wrong, and the charity's two board members won't say who controls its $60 million bankroll. This is according to a press investigation. Black Lives Matter's shocking lack of transparency surrounding its finances and its operations raises major legal and ethical red flags, multiple charity experts indicated. Charity Watch executive director Lori Styron, she said of Black Lives Matter. Now, we're talking here about the organization, not the idea of Black Lives Matter, but the organization. She says, like a giant ghost ship full of treasure drifting into the night with no captain, no discernible crew, and no clear direction. That's how she described them. Black Lives Matter co-founder Patrice Cullors appointed two activists to serve as the group's senior directors following her resignation in May amid scrutiny over her personal finances, but both quietly announced in September that they never took the jobs due to disagreements with Black Lives Matter. They told the Washington Examiner they don't know who now leads the nation's most influential social justice organization. Paul Kaminar, counsel for conservative watchdog group, the National Legal and Policy Center, said a full audit and investigation into Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation, the legal entity that represents the nation, the national movement, is warranted. He says this is grossly irregular and improper for a nonprofit with $60 million in its coffers. Black Lives Matter previously came under fire from local black activists after the New York Post reported that in April, Cullors, that was the lady that I just mentioned, one of the founders of Black Lives Matter, who was then its executive director, had spent $3.2 million on real estate across the United States. The reports followed Black Lives Matter's disclosure in February of 2021 that it closed out 2020 with $60 million in its bank accounts. Black Lives Matter denied allegations that Cullors spent Black Lives Matter funds on her personal properties. However, Black Lives Matter and other activist organizations under Cullors' control offered contracts to an art company led by the father of her only child. Cullors announced in May she was stepping down and that activists Makani Themba and Monifa Bandele would lead the organization as senior executives. But Themba and Bandele revealed in September that they never actually took the job because of disagreements with Black Lives Matter and its acting leadership council. Both Themba and Bandele told the Washington Examiner that they do not know who took over Black Lives Matter's top executive spots after their departure, and they also refused to say who serves on the council. I mean, that's, I think that'd be a matter of public record, but perhaps it's not. While a charity's finances are ultimately the responsibility of its board of directors, Black Lives Matter's bylaws explicitly state that its executive director, quote, shall have charge of all funds and securities of the corporation. The two remaining Black Lives Member board members, Shalamaya Bowers and Raymond Howard, did not return numerous requests for comment asking who has been in charge of Black Lives Matter and its money since Cullors left the charity in May. Bowers served as the treasurer for multiple activist organizations run by Cullors, including BLM PAC and a Los Angeles-based jail reform group that paid Cullors $20,000 a month and dropped nearly $26,000 for quote-unquote meetings at a luxury Malibu beach resort in 2019. Bowers declined to comment when reached by phone on Monday. Howard has spoken openly on Facebook about his work with Black Lives Matter and his close relationship with Cullors, but he apparently has recently taken steps to conceal his role within the charity. As recently as last Friday, Howard's LinkedIn profile stated that he is the director of operations for, quote, an international social justice organization. His page was modified after the Washington Examiner contacted him for a comment and now states that he serves as the director of operations for a, quote, nonprofit. A reference to Howard's position as the finance and operations manager of the New Impact Partners, a Dayton, Ohio-based consulting firm owned by his sister, was also removed from his LinkedIn profile. Also, as recently as last Friday, a website for New Impact Partners attributed a quote to Raymond from Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation, thanking the consulting firm for its help in solving Black Lives Matter's organizational challenges. The attribution was removed from the website after the Washington Examiner asked Howard how much BLM has paid his sister's firm. Despite New Impact Partners' apparent efforts to conceal its affiliation with BLM, the consulting firm continues to solicit applications for its talent network, which it says will connect job applicants directly to BLM and other activist organizations. Longtime charity expert Doug White said it's a red flag that BLM won't answer basic questions about its finances or its leadership structure. White says $60 million is not chump change. What BLM does is of tremendous social importance. That they won't give an honest or complete or straightforward answer in regards to which leadership is a concern. Not only do they not have an executive director right now, we think, but they also don't want to tell you how the organization is being run. BLM was not a charity in its own right for much of 2020, a year in which it received a windfall of cash from big corporations and individual donors, spurred by the police killing of George Floyd and the nationwide riots that followed. Rather, BLM spent most of the year essentially borrowing the charitable status of two other California-based charities, Thousand Currents and the Tides Foundation, which served as BLM's fiscal sponsors. But the IRS granted BLM tax-exempt status in December of 2020, enabling the group to operate as a charity independent of its former fiscal sponsors, and Thousand Currents reported in its most recent audited financial statements that it transferred $66.5 million directly into BLM's coffers in October of 2020. Cullors signed the asset transfer on behalf of Black Lives Matter on September 16, 2020, according to a copy of the agreement on file with the California Attorney General. BLM published a report last February saying that it incurred $8.4 million in operating expenses in 2020 and that it closed out the year with $60 million under its control. Watchdog groups are pointing out that there should be a full audit to clear up these apparent discrepancies, including things like a line item of $12,706,366 for professional fees, expenditures during the same calendar year, a figure $4.3 million higher than the top line annual spending figure that it reported to the public in February. Bottom line, from this watchdog group, lots of questionable financial activity, organizational structure, location of the books, etc., all of that that calls for a full investigation. Just a conclusion here, data that should be contained within Black Lives Matter's Form 990 tax return for 2020, which was due to the IRS in November, would help clear up the organization's $4.3 million spending discrepancy. The Washington Examiner attempted to request the the 2020 Form 990 in person at the BLM offices in Los Angeles, only to be told by security guards that there never has been a BLM office at that location. Curious. So, you know, I don't know if BLM is on your list of organizations that you give to charitably, but it would be probably worth your time to look into that to see what exactly is going on there. And that article is available at the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show. It's also available on the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. Let's go to John now in Burlington, Massachusetts. Hi, John.
My question has to do with the words of consecration and the validity. Okay. The words for many are in there, and sometimes some priest may try to say for all. And I think it was St. Thomas that explained why we say for many and not for all. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, if the priest changes those words, is the consecration still valid?
It is, for this reason, that the form of the canon of the Mass, which includes the words of institution, were modified under Pope Benedict XVI, and thankfully so, because the clunkiness of many of the prayers of the Mass prior to that revision were problematic in many ways, let's put it that way. One of the problems was that translation into English did not accurately translate from the Latin, which says pro multis. The underlying official Latin text says for many. And that, of course, was the language, that was the phrase that Jesus used at the Last Supper. Doesn't mean that he didn't die for all. He did die for all. For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believed in him would not perish but have eternal life. But at the Last Supper, the Lord himself said, "This is the chalice of my blood, which will be poured out for you and for many." And there he's referring to the effect of salvation for those who have been redeemed. All of us were redeemed. Not all of us will be saved. So there it's a reference to those who will be saved as a result of the shed blood of Jesus. So when the revision under Pope Benedict XVI took place, it was correctly translated as for many, which is the form that we've heard for, these last 10 years or so. But even if, either through forgetfulness or maybe even willful maliciousness, even if a priest were to change that, it still would not invalidate the consecration of the Eucharist, because the essential element for the consecration of the Eucharist does not include those words. It's specifically the words, "This is my body and this is my blood." So if the priest is using valid form and matter, and that would be the valid form to say at least those words, and using the valid matter of grape wine and unleavened bread with nothing added to it, and if he had the intention to consecrate, and if he were validly ordained a priest, then it would be valid. It would be illicit, we could say, for the priest to modify the words of the canon if he did so, you know, intentionally, as opposed to just being forgetful about it. That would be illicit, so it would be sinful for him, but it wouldn't invalidate the sacrament thereby.
I see. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Happy to clear it up, John, and I appreciate your phone call. Let's go now to Cynthia in San Marcos, Texas. Welcome.
Patrick, I had a call. I mean, I had a follow-up question similar to the woman that called a while ago.
Okay.
I have a brother. He's a little bit older. He's like probably about 66. And he has a girlfriend, a woman who, I'm sorry, somebody's trying to call me. I'm just going to get rid of that.
Just ignore them.
I'm okay. So sorry.
That's okay.
So sorry. Scam
Please
call.
Proceed.
Anyway, they live pretty close to each other. So he spends the night with her pretty often. I know he's in love with her. She is a baptized Catholic. She says that her mom made her go to church all her life. So she almost hates the church is what it sounds like. She hates his crosses that he has all over a wall in his living room. She says, too much Jesus, too much Jesus. She says the GD word all the time. Mm-hmm. I don't want to talk smack about her. I'm sure she's a lovely person. I met her one time. I know that she is lacking that beautiful closeness with Jesus. Probably she never got that, maybe. And I pray for her very often. But it's caused a little distance between my brother and myself. Mm-hmm. He was a daily communicant, and he loves Our Lady. And I just see him kind of quietly suffering. You know, I ask him, brother, have you been back to church? He's at first he was like, oh, no, COVID. And I'm like, well, you go to the grocery store. You know,
are these two just boyfriend, girlfriend, or are they, I mean, is it more than just
boyfriend, girlfriend? Mm-hmm. Well, they're boyfriend, girlfriend, but Patrick, they might as well live together. And that's how much time they spend together. And he stays with her overnight very often.
Okay, so they're probably engaging in sexual intercourse.
Oh, I'm 99% sure they are.
Okay.
I try to give him a lot of respect. He's my older brother. But I'm kind of like his spiritual mom, even though I'm younger. And he lets me, you know, I know you love Our Lady, and don't you miss being in Mass and the Eucharist? And
I think
when I remind him, yeah. So I was just fixing to call him, matter of fact. What can I say to him that I'm not pounding him over the head, but I really don't know what to say.
All right. Let me give you something you can do. It may seem a little bit over the top, but I've seen it work before. And if he's 66, I mean, he's not an old man, but he's not a young man anymore either. So he doesn't have a lot of runway left, even if he lives for another 20 years. And death can come for any of us at any time. So my advice would be give him a book that's called The Dogma of Hell. It's not a terribly long book, but it is an attention-getting book because it's a description of what hell is going to be like, what it is like, what the Bible says about hell, the pains of hell. And, you know, you can maybe, if you want to do it like a tongue-in-cheek, ha-ha, wink-wink, nudge-nudge. But the message would be, listen, what you're doing, and you know as well as I do that what you're doing is wrong, that you're cutting corners and you're committing some serious sins. Now, he's probably willing to put up with the rough edges of this woman because she's giving him something else in return, and he kind of likes that, so he's willing to overlook things. So try it. What have you got to lose? You know, tell him, I love you. I want to see you happy forever in heaven, and the road you're on right now is not leading you to heaven. It's leading you to hell. And by the way, here's a book that talks about hell. And I wouldn't be surprised if after he gets over his shock, he starts flipping through that book, and he has a
Patrick,
he has a turnaround.
Oh, here, right next to my house. I've got a call. I'm so sorry. Right.
Okay, I'll let you go. Adios. Adios. That's my recommendation. Give it a try. I'll be right back. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show, coast to coast on Relevant Radio.
Wow. Pretty jazzy. I like it. Let's go to Ann in Helena, Montana. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I have a question, and I'm not sure how to explain it, so I'll do my best.
Okay.
My dad and I were talking about the gospel reading of Mark chapter 4 on Wednesday, and we kind of train around. Anyway, my question is, when Jesus came down in the incarnation, mm-hmm. I know he was fully divine and fully human.
Right.
However, there was always the Trinity, and God knows everything for all eternity.
Mm-hmm.
When he was here, did he give that up?
No. No. So what happened in the incarnation was that God, the second person of the Trinity, the Son, he united a perfect human nature to his divine nature. So he, Jesus, is a divine person who has naturally the divine nature, but also a human nature. So he, I mean, there, it would be impossible for him to cease being God, if that's what you're asking, or like to
No, I knew he was always God, but it, okay. Did he know at the time when he asked Judas to be his apostle, he knew already that he was going to betray him?
Yes.
Did he know his suffering that was going to happen on the cross before it happened?
Yes. And evidence of that, okay. is in the Garden of Gethsemane, where Jesus, knowing what was going to happen, asks the Father, Father, if it be your will, let this chalice pass from me, but not my will, but thine be done. So Jesus knew, certainly knew in his human intellect what was coming. And in his divine intellect, of course, he knows everything, everything that can be known. So he
okay.
did know.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay. Because my dad and I were talking, and he's like, well, maybe he didn't know till the garden that that was going to happen to him. But prior to the garden, he may not have known. So that was our question.
No, it's a very good question.
Knew.
No, he did know, and there's ample evidence of that. So in certain passages, Jesus talks about when the Son of Man is lifted up, and he's referring to his crucifixion, when he's lifted up on the cross. Or as you know, shortly before his passion, he said in the temple precincts, he said, this temple, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will rebuild it. And he was talking about the temple of his body, and of course the resurrection. His hearers thought that he was speaking about the stones of the temple built by Herod the Great. Jesus many times talked about how he came into the world to suffer. In fact, St. Peter argued with him and said, Lord, we're not going to let this happen. And that's when Jesus rebuked him. And he said, get behind me, Satan, because you're thinking like men as opposed to how God thinks. So Jesus gave many clues along the way, and not always clues, but sometimes very explicitly, that he was clearly knowing where he was going and what he was doing. It wasn't a mystery to him, as some say.
Okay. Could I trouble you with one more question? It has to do with the gospel on
okay.
Wednesday.
Okay.
I've listened to it obviously for years, but there's a part that really captured my attention when he's talking about the parable and he says to the apostles, they listen and may not hear and all that. But the part that mm-hmm. got me was that they may not convert and be forgiven. Why wouldn't he want them converted at that time?
Well, this ties into something known as the messianic secret, where you'll notice that Jesus, in some instances, he'll perform a miracle, and then he'll tell he sternly rebuked them to tell no one. And what you're asking ties into this. The messianic secret is understood as it wasn't time yet for Jesus to be fully revealed, or in some cases, it wasn't time yet for the gospel to be preached by the apostles in the 70s. And so some of the, and this would be one of them, I would argue, would be where Jesus was saying, it's not time yet, but the time is coming. And of course, Jesus wants everybody to convert and be saved. He warned about that. But in his own plan for salvation, it wasn't opportune yet for that to happen. One other example of this is where you'll notice that he will rebuke the devil and tell the devil to be silent, or somebody who was possessed by a devil to be silent. And the reason is because it would not have been appropriate, it would not have been fitting for that sort of personage to be telling the gospel to other people. That was something that was reserved first and foremost to Jesus himself, and then to his appointed apostles and disciples. So that's what you're seeing in that. Hopefully that's helpful. Let's go now to Luis in Los Angeles. Hi, Luis.
Sure. Okay, I have a question. Sometimes after work, I go to the local parish by my work, and I pray the rosary, but I do it with my Bluetooth on and, you know, listening to the relevant radio app. I don't know, is that okay?
Absolutely.
Or is that, yeah?
Absolutely, yeah. So the Lord smiles, Our Lady smiles when you pray the rosary, and if you're using Bluetooth or loudspeakers or anything like that, that's totally fine.
Okay, okay. I feel much better now because I don't know, if, you know, people looking around me with a, you know, headphone on or something, you know. And I have one more question. Also, is there like a time, like if I get to church late, is there like, do I have to be there from the beginning to receive the Holy Communion?
Yes. Okay, so this is a great question. So you're referring to receiving Holy Communion at any given Mass, right? Or are you referring to your Sunday obligation? Or are you referring to both?
Both. Okay. Because what happened was yesterday after work, I went to church, and I got there maybe about 15 minutes late. And I kind of, I didn't know if I was able to receive Holy Communion since I wasn't there from the beginning of the Mass.
Okay, got it. I can answer that. So these are two distinct but related issues. With regard to the Sunday obligation, the typical customary way of looking at it is that as long as you get to Mass on time, but if something prevents you and you're unable to get to Mass, as long as you're there by or before the start of the offertory, so after the Liturgy of the Word is concluded, if you're there before or by that time, it is generally assumed to be that you made your Sunday obligation. It's not great because you should have been there on time, but sometimes you can't. If you get there after that, so let's say you arrive at the time of the consecration, you have missed Mass, and so your Sunday obligation has not been fulfilled. And that would mean then that if there's a later Mass that you can get to, you're obligated to go to that Mass. You can't just blow it off. You can't just say, oh, well, I was late for the 10:30 Mass, and I'm not going to go to, you still have to fulfill your Sunday obligation. There is a school of thought that I personally do not share, but some people would say that if you are not there by the time the gospel is proclaimed, then you have missed Mass. Now, that's not the traditional way of looking at it. That's not the custom of longstanding, but there are some people who would say that. So if you ask somebody else, he might say, well, you have to be there for the gospel. But strictly speaking, I think that first standard would be a safe bet. Now, you can receive Holy Communion even if you walk into Mass as they're distributing Holy Communion. So if you walk into Mass, any Mass, and you're properly disposed, of course, you're in the state of grace, and you have, you know, recollected yourself, you could walk straight in, get in the communion line, and receive Holy Communion. There is no restriction on that. And similarly, there's no restriction about you have to be at Mass by a certain time before you can receive Holy Communion. Now, ideally, you should receive Holy Communion within the context of having been at Mass from the beginning. But there is no obligation to do so, and you're not committing a sin if you walked right in and you received Holy Communion. But that's different from the obligation to be at Mass for Sunday, for your Sunday obligation. Do you see the distinction between the two?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's say that you missed your Sunday obligation because you got to Mass on Sunday late, too late to count for your Sunday obligation. You can still receive Holy Communion, but you're still obliged to go to Mass later in that day if that's possible. Now, under normal circumstances, you wouldn't go to Mass, you wouldn't receive communion at that second Mass. There are some circumstances where you can do that, so a wedding or a funeral Mass, things like that. But even if you don't make your Sunday obligation, you can still receive Holy Communion if you came in late at that first Mass. Do you see?
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Good. I'm pressed for time, so I've got a jet, as they say. Let's go to Raina now in Lehighton, Pennsylvania. Hi, Raina.
Hi, Patrick. I have a daughter who's a senior, and she's involved.
I'm going to have to apologize. I didn't look closely at the clock, Raina. and there's not going to be enough time. The music's going to start playing in just a second. So my sincere apologies. Could you call me on Monday or call me on Tuesday, and I'll be happy to take your call then?
I'll definitely try. Thank you.
Please do. I apologize. Yeah, I thought I had a little more time than I had. But as Cyrus likes to remind me, a man's got to know his limitations. Right, Cyrus?
You are correct, sir. Yes.
All right. Well, hey, we did it. Another week. And we're that much closer to heaven. But hopefully not too close quite yet anyway. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. I will pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.